Hello everyone, and welcome back. Another week. Episode 14 of Season 2 is here, but first I want to say a massive, massive thank you again to the hundreds and hundreds of you who are tuning in, week out on this podcast, listening to people's stories on their mental health challenges. I'm hoping you're getting a lot out of it. I certainly am getting an amazing amount of, out of the people that I get on every single week. Last week was no different with Damien Brown, who is one of the most extraordinary people I've had on this podcast so far. Rowing the Atlantic solo, generally being a mind wizard, his ability to control his behavior and how his mind is wired is just unbelievable. If you haven't listened to that episode, honestly, it's 2 hours long, yes, but it is an amazing episode. Please do give it a listen. We're slap bang in the middle of another lockdown in the UK, and there are a huge amount of people who are struggling right now. And I made a decision at the start of December, which has dramatically improved my quality of life. And I want to be open about it the start of this podcast. I started taking a course of antidepressants, sertraline actually, to be precise, at the start of December, and I was initially quite sceptical. I think there's a lot of stigma attached to antidepressants, unfortunately. If you try and talk about it with people, it's kind of a no-go. What I found is actually speaking to people who are taking them, it is like collaboration. It's really quite cool, and there is a community of people out there on antidepressants who are living a really good life. Like I'm one of them now. Taking antidepressants has been a revelation for me. For the first time in 2 years, I think I can properly cognitively function again without being bombarded by mental exhaustion, because my mind was all over the place. It was so difficult to control it, so difficult. Antidepressants won't solve all my problems. Chemically, there is still something imbalanced in my brain, and they are a temporary solution. I'll give everybody that. But I'm deliberately being open and honest and vulnerable with my truth here, about being on antidepressants, because I think people should know there's a wealth of solutions out there. Although some of them are more daunting than others, there is help out there. It gets better. There is nothing to be ashamed of about being open and vulnerable with your truth. Nothing. I will continue to take antidepressants. I'll continue to take sertraline because it's improved my mental health. It's improved my ability to live my life. And they're supporting me in my recovery, and they're helping me. So, if you need help, you must go and get it. Do not be afraid. Seek help, please. There you go. Let's be open and vulnerable with our truths right now. Go and get the best help possible. It is so, so worth it. As always, thanks to our sponsors, Cornerstone and Looseheads. If you're a regular listener to this podcast, you will know that Cornerstone are your all-in-one men's health box delivered to your door every month, and you can pick and choose what goes on in your box. So from personalized shaving products to mouthwash and toothpaste to hair loss preventing shampoo and conditioner and loads more. You can even get Viagra if you're struggling to get the old boy up. You can get £10 off your first box by clicking on the link in the show notes below this episode, or by going to www.cornerstone.co.uk/rut. You will also be supporting this podcast if you do so, because Cornerstone have very kindly given us a profit share. So just if you fancy supporting this podcast, buy a box. Why not? It's almost free. Now on to this week's episode, and I've gone on there for 4.5 minutes, but now on to this week's episode, and I am so pleased to welcome a friend of mine. He's become a friend of mine. He has come on and shared his story with this podcast today. Will Hurrell is an ex-professional rugby player, having played for the likes of Bristol Bears, Bath and Leicester Tigers. He has an unbelievable story, which he's laid bare in this episode. A story of alcohol abuse, persistent mental health battles, playing his way up from National League One after being dropped from Leicester Tigers Academy, but playing his way up from National League One to be considered in the England squad only very recently as a incredibly abrasive and hard ball carrying ginger centre. He is the ginger Manatu Elangi. He really is. Well, he was, until he had to retire in January 2020 because Will suffered a stroke whilst playing against Leicester Tigers at Welford Road after taking a massive bang on the head, on the back of his head actually. Will had to retire from rugby because his injury sustained to his brain was so severe. There's a huge debate, obviously, in rugby at the moment, and in other sports actually, ongoing about the impact of concussion has on rugby players and sportsmen and women in general. It is a hugely important topic, and Will, thankfully, has survived to tell the tale of having a stroke whilst playing professional rugby on BT Sport live on TV. I mean, it is ridiculous. He now suffers agonising headaches, dizziness, loss of memory, and more because of the stroke. However, this is Will's story. What happened that day, it is the story of what happened that day at Welford Road and how Will has overcome his battles with his mental health. So, Will Hurrell, welcome to the RUP, my friend. As always, please leave all judgment at the door. Mr. Will, is it Hurrell or Hurrell?
It depends who you speak to. If you ask the boys, it's Hurrell. If you ask my mum, it'd be Hurrell. But
okay, what do you prefer?
Oh, Hurrell's fine. Hurrell's
Hurrell, okay.
Or Hurricane, whatever's easiest.
The Hurricane Hurrell or Hurrell, whatever it may be, welcome to the RUT. How are you?
Yeah, really good, mate. Really good. Been very busy. Yeah, just starting helping run a new business is something new for me. So getting to grips with that. It's not the same as rugby, but it's exciting and yeah, busy. Just I really want the rugby below the Prem to start back up because obviously I'm coaching at Plymouth now, and those boys are getting a bit twitchy. And you know, I want.
Have you got any insight from the powers that be as to when that might kick off again?
Oh, mate, there's been a load of chat. It was initially October, then it was November, and potentially we're looking at a January start with some sort of cup going on.
Right.
Which, yeah, it's an interesting one, but I think they need to do something just for, you know, otherwise we're going to lose grassroots rugby, I think.
Oh, yeah, we're before this... Before you start recording, I had a little cheeky stalk of your Twitter and just to see what, because I often think like social media obviously gives quite a good indicator of the life and times and the mind of somebody. I dread to think what people would see if they went further enough back on my Twitter. So please, nobody do that. But yeah, you've been talking about grassroots rugby a lot, and it seems like you're quite passionate about it now.
Yeah, I mean, it's huge for me because not like most of the professional premiership players that sort of academy and stayed there. I dropped right down. So I played level four, National 2, Stourbridge with my brother, and I had to fight my way right back up to the Prem. And, you know, that year where Donny played Bristol in the final, four of us, or it could have been five of us, from the Donny team went into premiership teams. And
who were they?
So there was me. Oh, you're going to test me now. Will Griff-John.
Oh, yeah. Blight. He did well as well.
Yeah. Michael Heaney.
Yeah.
And there were more. I can't remember.
That's fine. We'll blame it on the stroke, which we'll get into later.
yeah. Right, that's an easy get out for me now, mate.
Absolutely. You forget your missus's name, and it's like, oh, don't worry.
That's happened once.
Really?
I called her the wrong name, and it was so embarrassed. Yeah.
Oh no. You've had quite the extraordinary year. In fact, you've had a pretty incredible couple of years. We'll get on to that in a bit. I just want to paint a picture for people who are listening. You're a Bristolian, right? Born and bred.
No, I was born in Leicester, mate. I was a Tiger. Oh,
my bad. Yeah, gosh, yeah.
I've been called that before. People think
you've got a Bristolian accent. I think.
Oh, don't.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if that's a bad thing.
Come on.
Yeah, Joe Bryan, who we had on the pod, wouldn't say so. But yeah, you've had a quite a topsy turvy year. I want to check in with and paint a picture of what it was like being Will Hurrell, whatever you want to call him, growing up.
Yeah.
And see how you grew up as a person, because it's not just been the last couple of years that you've struggled with your mental health, right?
No, yeah, I've had lots of up and downs, mate. And
take me back to when you were young.
Young, so yeah, I just loved.
What
rugby,
was it like,
mate?
Rugby, yeah.
Yeah, it was all rugby, mate. I bloody love rugby. I'm a proper rugby nors, and always have been since I was little. Always something I wanted to do full time. I loved it. I would play whenever I could. Three times a week I was playing at one stage, at college and that. But yeah, all growing up, it was all rugby, mate. Just wanted to constantly be out. I did athletics. I tried everything. I was just a really sporty kid. Sort of growing up, it was tough. I always felt like I stood out quite a lot.
Why?
I was always bigger than everyone else. I was a big ginger mong, really pale, like, you know, just a bit different, just a bit different to everyone else, you know. And when you stand out like that, you are going to attract, you know, a lot of, you know, I'm going to say banter, you know, different things. So it's
what would people say to you?
Well, I've got the usual, yeah, ginger pubes, you know, you look like a ghost, and yeah, you know, all the usual crack for being ginger. But because you stand out, you attract more of that when you stand out, especially growing up, you do. And
how did that affect you? Because interestingly, the way I see it, and I was kind of, I don't know whether you were bullied per se. I mean, name calling is obviously unpleasant, but it can kind of go one of two ways with people at a young age. It can either make them really battle hardened, really quite angry, and just hating everybody that comes in sight, or calls them an air very defensive, or it can make them quite soft, in which they're a bit like, they've become withdrawn, they start hating themselves, and that comes out in their life. Like, which kind of pathway did you go down? Or,
well, I think, and when we talk about sort of troubles I've had, it's because I sort of flip between the two. I'd say that I'm, you know, I portray, and I always have done, because I do attract a lot of that, not criticism, but we'll say banter, but because I attracted a lot of that, it meant that I always portrayed myself as overconfident.
Right.
So everyone would say, oh, he's a right cocky twat. I got that all the time growing up. And that was sort of my way of saying, no, I'm better than what you're saying. You know, I had all the chat as well. Oh, you're just a big lad. You're not going to be a good rugby player because you're a big lad. Everyone will catch up. That was the shit I always heard, mate. Everyone will catch up. And it was those things that sort of stick with you, and you say, well, no, I'm going to show these idiots that I am strong. I am stronger than them. I am better than them. And it did come across as cocky. And when I was at Tigers, I had academy coaches tell me that, you know, I used to bleach my hair. They'd make me go home, shave it off. And, you know, I was flamboyant. I was mouthy. But I was a really good player. And, you know,
who was in your little cohort in Tigers Academy?
So we had a hell of a year. We had Ben Youngs, Manu Tuilagi, Callum Green, who's a Leicester.
He's back at Leicester.
But we had a load of those boys, a really strong academy side that did exceptionally well. And, you know, it was, Leicester was tough though. The way they sort of ran stuff, this is going back sort of 12, 13 years now, but it was still very old school, like, you know, oh, we're going to push these rusty cars around this pitch. And, you know, yeah, it was very old. And that worked for them at that point. It did. They were the best team around. You know, they had Jordan Murphy, they had Lewis Moody, Ben Kay. And these are all the guys that I grew up with. And, you know, those three in particular were actually really nurturing as like sort of rugby idols. But the coaching style, it was very tough. Richard Cockrell as well, he was in charge when I was there, and he was really tough. And I don't think, let me turn that off, my light's just going off. He was very tough. And, you know, Leicester didn't like people that stood out, that sort of came across as cocky or, but that was just my persona back then. It was just the way that I dealt with, like you say, a lot of the banter and the name calling growing up that I received. So, you know, it was a tough time there, and I thought I would have stayed there longer than I did. And it was a bit of a shock when I got released. And that was my first sort of big kick in the pants, like, you're not good enough, see you later. And you sort of have to reevaluate then, and you're going, oh, I thought I'd be playing first team here. And I did play a few games, and, you know, I played reasonably well. And
how did you deal with that?
I mean, I sort of in my head just turned around and said, oh, they're full of shit. I'll go to London Welsh, which was who I signed for afterwards. I'll play there and I'll get back in the Prem. That was the thing I was thinking in my head. I spent that year at London Welsh and played a fair few games there and, you know, did reasonably well. I was still a young lad, only sort of 20, but still, you know, this cocky young lad. You know, they ended up getting promoted. It was the first time they got promoted out of those two times. That was that year we played that. And then again, ended up getting released from there. And I was like, wow, okay.
Did they give you any indication as to why?
I think they just weren't that fussed. And they got into the Prem and they signed. It was that New Zealand line they bloody signed.
Oh, they signed
Perry Weepu and the 10, what's his name?
What, Kiwi 10?
No, he played a bit of England. He'd been around. But anyway, that's going to annoy us, isn't it? Everyone will be shouting, saying, we know who this is.
Bartley?
Ollie Bartley, that's it.
Yeah.
We got that together.
I mean, look at this. Two rugby noses going at it from London Welsh first team, like 2012.
So they signed boys like that. And
didn't they? So they got, you'd obviously left, but I mean, this is more nosing, but they'd signed about 30 players at once over that summer, which is never a good idea. Oh, they signed some fucking good ones as well. Ollie Bartley, Perry Weeper were two. Didn't they sign Gavin Henson as well?
Yeah, probably. I know, funnily enough, I played with Gavin at Bristol. I really like him. He's a really good guy. And he's a proper rugby nose as well.
Really?
And he's had a lot of bad press, but he is a really good guy.
He's had awful press.
He's a good guy, though.
Really?
One of my favourites, actually. You know, favourite rugby player I've ever met. But
loves the piss in the tan.
Yeah. Do you know, actually, he doesn't. He's actually very level-headed, yeah. Do you know, he's just had a couple of bad occasions, and because he was in the press, It's exactly what you said. That's what people think of him. And unfortunately, when you are in the press, you can't have those hiccups. Otherwise, you do get that label very quickly. And again, that's, you know, linked to mental health, that, you know, there's a lot of people that have made mistakes and it's difficult to get over of them when you're constantly reminded of them, isn't it?
So, I mean, you look at Danny Cipriani. He's the perfect example. Like, I'm a WASP fan.
Exactly.
And for me, I grew up watching him at WASPs in like 07, 08 when he was the next big thing, made his England debut versus Ireland and scored like 40 points or something ridiculous.
Yeah.
And then through a series of various issues in his private life, has been chastised by the press.
Yeah.
And I just leave them alone. Leave people alone. What is the point? But sex sells, you know?
It does. It does. And it's a good story. And they want to... sorry about that. Mum's coming in.
Mum Harrell.
quickly disappeared. It does. Like you say, it's a good story. But, you know, this is... always been my big problem with those sorts of papers that want to do those chastising columns and stuff. They have no interest what the repercussions of that are. You know, and it's cutthroat, and you know, you've got to be so careful about what happens. It really can affect people's mental health, and I know for a fact that boys have really suffered with stuff that's come out and stuff. So it's an interesting one.
Let's get back to your story. You're released by London Welsh. And in and amongst all of this, we have this kind of storm brewing in the background in your mind. You went from London Welsh to Doncaster Knights, right?
No, I went London Welsh. So I actually went to Rotherham for a month, and I hated it there. I've got to be honest. I really didn't like it. I didn't like the place. I had a fight at the first social because I was
really?
I was this big ginger, loud, lippy dude, and this guy that had been at Rotherham for 472 years wanted to he took offence to it, and we ended up having a scrap in my first sort of couple of weeks there, and I was thinking, fucking, I hate this. And
really?
Yeah, and don't get me wrong, I'm not having a dig at Rotherham. It was
no, of course.
It was the way I was at the moment, and I just didn't fit in there. And, you know, I ended up leaving there after a month, and I thought, again, Champ Club, try and bounce back up to the Prem. And after that, I just thought, what the hell am I going to do? I got.
How old are you at this stage?
21, I think.
21. Wow.
Yeah, I got done drink driving as well that period while I was there.
Right.
Really, really tough time for me.
What's all this linked to? I mean, what was going on in your mind at that stage? Because obviously, there's rugby. And most rugby players, not every rugby player, because there are some rugby players that don't get these kind of setbacks. But most rugby players do get these setbacks. But I kind of get the feeling there was something else going on.
I mean, I just don't think I coped with failure very well.
Right.
And in my mind, I was that I'd failed. You know, and I felt like I probably should have succeeded straight from the off. And, you know, it was my lack of coping with failure that I think caused a lot of my issues. The fact,
what do you think it was about failure?
I don't know, to be honest. I don't know. It probably stemmed from that, me being young, thinking I need to be better than everyone else. You know, I kicked on so early with rugby that I got into the England 16s a year early. I was the only one to do it. So I was the year below everyone else there. And from that set the bar here. And I thought that's where I'm at. And I just, yeah, when I don't hit that, it's tough. It's tough to take. So that I think that's where a lot of that comes from.
It's fascinating. Failure is, I listen to a lot of podcasts, I don't know if you do too, and also I read a lot. I'm being curious. Yeah. I often see entrepreneurs, sports people. Have you ever listened to Jake Humphrey's High Performance Podcast?
No.
Mate, you should. They've got some wicked people on that. And they explore the art of failure and the kind of mindset of these high-performing people or people who've basically just been incredibly talented and have the right mindset, right? So they can excel, is that failure is necessary. But when actually, to grow, but when you're in the moment of failing, it's like the world's ending.
Yeah. Yeah, I'd agree.
And for you, who set your life on rugby, right? This is all you're a grade one rugby Norse from Leicester, all your bread is to literally from minute one is to have a rugby ball in your hands. Yeah,
yeah,
it's fucking horrific.
Yeah, it was, mate. And you know, failure is something I've had to learn to deal with and learn to use, actually. And it's taken me a long time to. It's only this sort of last year where I've got to a stage where I've used my own failures to actually propel me forward. You know, and before this, you know, if what happened to me in the last year happened 10 years ago, I don't think I'd be here. And that's really me being brutally honest. Yeah. 100%. So it's how do you give people the tools? Because like you said, most people are going to fail 90%. And it's how do you give people those tools to be able to use failure as a positive rather than a negative? And really make it the best out of it that you can. And I think that's the key thing, isn't it? Is creating 100%. That mentality.
When we were talking on the phone a couple of months ago, you were talking to me about the kind of mindset and mentality of dropping down into National 2. Because actually you went down to National 2, and which I can imagine in your eyes is like, the way I see it from Will Harrell's perspective, and you can put me wrong here, is that you probably felt a bit embarrassed being there. And that's no disrespect to National 2, but somebody who's come through a Tigers Academy, England 16s, has played in the Premiership, and then rocks up in National 2. Which club were you at in National 2?
I was at Stourbridge. I actually played with my older brother.
Which would have been quite fun, I imagine.
Yeah, it was fun. It was fun. And do you know, I wasn't embarrassed that I was there, but I was embarrassed. Do you know what I do get embarrassed about is the route that I got there. That's what embarrasses me. So
what is explain.
So the fact that, you know, I played a few games at Leicester and I, you know, a failure there, released. You know, quite a few games at London Welsh, a failure there, released. Then at Rotherham, didn't like it, didn't get on, scrap, drink driving, released into Stourbridge. That route is what I'm embarrassed about, not the fact that I'm there, if that makes sense. And that's something I really struggle to get over sometimes. When I get tired, when I get down, when I get overworked, I think about these decisions that I've made in my life, and I find it really difficult to swallow it sometimes. I think that's normal, but it's I always talk about bounce back, in the fact that like we've said, people are going to fail. I've always credited myself on my bounce back ability, so my ability to have these failures and then bounce back and do something good. That's what I would pride myself on, to be honest.
I was reading an article that you had been featured in. I think it was on Rugby Pass before this. And you were talking about how you have two, your two most favorite memories of your playing career are two games. The championship playoff final against Bristol, and then rocking up outside Gavin Henson playing for Bristol, I think it was the following season. And you're talking about how in National 2, you're on £100 a game. And you're thinking, where on earth do I go from here? Because presumably you're working outside of that.
I went to uni, actually,
Right, okay. So talk to me about going from National 2 to a championship playoff final, and that, I suppose, that moment, I'm interested to explore the moment where you're almost rock bottom in many senses of your playing career, and what decision you consciously took to bounce back, as you call it.
I think, do you know, I don't think it was an immediate thing. I think it was a gradual thing for me. And thinking back, you know, I can remember playing at Stourbridge, and it was getting that enjoyment back, you know, playing with my big brother. You know, we had such a good crack. We would sort of before the game, we'd be like, right, let's see who can put the biggest hit in after the ball's gone and stuff like this. And, you know, and once I started enjoying it again, it lit that fire again. And it was probably, I reckon, about halfway through that season where I was hell-bent on getting Stourbridge promoted. We'd won, I think it was like 19 games in a row. And I was hell-bent on getting them promotion. And, you know, that I was really fighting for that. And, you know, I was doing my uni work, but I was training an awful lot on my own and then doing loads of extra stuff on my own skills and that, and then playing for Stourbridge. And when we just missed out promotion to National 1, I got an offer to go to Coventry. And I think it was that moment where I said, I want to be back in the Prem. I want to be a Premiership player. You know, essentially, I want to get into England, which unfortunately I never made, but I want to get back into the Prem. And I think it was that moment where sort of we missed out on promotion with Stourbridge, but then I went to Coventry. I said, right, this is going to be my pathway.
It's fascinating. What was your mindset then?
It was just be the best. It was, you know, and that's essentially what it was, just be the best. You know, and at that point I played centre for Stourbridge, but then Coventry wanted me back on the wing. And I said to him, fine. I said, look, I'll play on the wing. I said, but I'm just going to pretty much do whatever I want. And they said, that's fine, do whatever you want. So then I was a winger, and genuinely I was getting about 20, 30 carries a game because I was running. I just, you know, when the forward was set to run up off nine, I just run a fucking shoulder ball and cut them all off and just carry it instead of the forwards. And I knew that was my way back, because that was something I was good at, was carrying the ball. And then, and I just set my sights on it. I said, this is how I'm going to do it. And, you know, I spent 2 years at Coventry, absolutely tearing
which by, up. Which by your YouTube highlight reel was some experience, because it's a fucking good one.
Coventry. Do you know what? That helped as well. I'll say Coventry's like, right in the middle of my heart always. I loved it there. Do you know, like, so I remember after every home game, you had to walk through this long bar, and the team dinners were right at the back of this bar, this long bar under the stadium, and all the fans were in there, and they used to have live music, and I used to come in after the game, right? And it used to take me, and this is no word of a lie, about 2 hours to get to the food because every fan was stood there and had a pint waiting for me. And I kid you not, there was times I'd have had 12 pints by the time I get to food because I wanted to stand with him. I wanted to chat with him about the game and about Coventry. And like, I just loved it there. I mean, there were most of those home games, we were in that under the stadium, under the stand till like sort of 11 at night because really? We were just, yeah, there was a few of us. We used to stay there with the fans. They had live music. There was times we'd have loads of beers and we'd be singing on with these bands and stuff. And like, it was that love and enjoyment and like all the success that I had there that really pushed me on, really.
What was Cov like for a night out?
Oh, it was
shocking.
Not great, shall we say.
Really?
Not great. But you know what? I've always said this. It doesn't matter where you go, it's who you're with. And those boys I was with, a few of them, there's a few of us used to go out quite a lot. But never cause any trouble, never in any fights, never too pissed. There's a few of us used to go out, and that group of us was a real tight group then, back there. You know, I had them come down to me in Birmingham at my uni and come out, and, you know, I still speak to them now, still in contact with them, even though everyone's out off doing different things. Funnily enough, a couple of them...
Who's in that team?
So, Tom Paul was close mate of mine. Matt Price, who's still out and about there doing community rugby. Brett Danes used to come out with us. You know, there was quite a few boys that were in this little tight-knit group. And, it was awesome crack. Really was.
Cov to Doncaster?
Donnie, yeah.
Yeah, because that, again, is some move.
yeah, it's again, it was just jumping up a league, and that's all I had in my head was jump up a league, right, and perform. That's all I had in my head. That's all I cared about. I'll be honest, that is all I cared about. I didn't care about anything else.
Because Cov and Nat won at that stage, right?
Yeah, Cov were Nat one and Donnie were in the champ. I was just purely focused on performing and moving up a league, and went up to Donny. I actually, funnily enough, I turned down a big pay rise and a good job to go to Donny. So I probably lost. Yeah.
Really?
So I probably lost about 30 grand going up to Donny.
Fucking hell.
But that is, I was that hell-bent on getting into the Prem. I said, I don't care. And I went up to Donny, didn't know anyone up there. I'd played with one lad, Sam Edgley. And I went up there, you know, miles away from any friends, from any family. Because
was he at Bedford? He was at Bedford.
I think
he
was, yeah. A little scrum half winger.
Yeah.
Really, really talented bloke, actually. Played a bit of England sevens and stuff. Hell of a rig on him. Jesus, man. Yeah. Guy was about 4 foot tall, about 2% body fat, and bench more than me. I was like,
really?
This animal, yeah. But, like I said, just didn't even know anyone up there, but I just didn't care. I was just like, I'm going for this. And... ended up having a really good season. Like, again, I hate to blow my own trumpet, but I just tore up. Like, I just tore up, and you know, we got into the semis and we pumped Leeds. Scored in both of those games, so I was flying high. And then we had that big final against Bristol.
I told you, we've spoken a few times now on the phone, and and I told you that I first started I suppose following like who the hell this massive ginger bloke was in the centre in that game, because it was very clear that you were like miles apart from the rest of the Knights, right? You were the best player in that team, and just firing into the
Bristol,
yeah.
Yeah.
But you lost, right? It was, what was it, 42-63 or something on aggregate?
Yeah.
Which is class game,
I mean, it was the first leg, wasn't it, that sealed it for us. Bristol played a really smart game, you know, box kicks, mauls, kept it tight. And they knew that had beat us in that first game. And I think they went in, it was either with a 14 or 21 point lead. I think it might have been 21, you know, or 14. I can't remember. But they had a really good game plan and they executed really well. And we went and we said, right, boys, let's just play. Let's see what we can do. And that game. I remember that game. It was incredible. Awesome.
Do you think you got picked up by Bristol from that game?
Yeah, no doubt.
Have you been told that?
No, but I don't see where else they would have. You know, they'd have obviously seen videos and stuff of the games, but that doesn't stick in your mind. You know, they wouldn't be thinking, "Oh, that guy was. Let's get him." They, you know, and it was those two final legs. I scored in the first leg. To bring us back some points, but then I scored in the second leg as well. I really don't like blowing my own trumpet, but I ran over about four people in this one run, and it's in front of a big crowd as well. It's just it's like a big selling point, isn't it? Like, oh,
of course.
Big ginger mong, and we've got promoted, and. You know, and actually that game, the Bristol fans were incredible. I reckon there must have been about 100 of them came up to me personally and said, "You were amazing. I hope we sign you."
And lo and behold, they did.
I was on BT Sports about 10 minutes later going, "No, I've signed at Donny. I'll never leave Donny." And then a month later, I'd signed at Bristol. and that's no disrespect to Donny. I loved it there. You know, really good set of lads. But like I said, I was hell-bent on playing Premiership. I was hell-bent on it.
Yeah, I mean, Britt, that first game where you're running out of Twickenham for Bristol, outside Gavin Henson, I mean,
incredible.
What is that feeling like?
I suppose you've just
realised your dream, actually. You've gone from National 2, 100 quid a game, to playing outside British and Irish Lions test player. Yeah. In Gavin Henson and one of the game's most recognised names at Twickenham on a professional contract full time with Bristol. I mean, that's an extraordinary, right? I mean, that must be quite emotional, no?
It was huge, actually. And I actually ran out, I think it was second behind Joe Joyce, because obviously that was massive for him as well. But Running out into that, I think there's about 70,000 people there because
we
played Quins, but Sarries were playing before as well. And it was just, you can never describe that feeling and you can never actually replicate it. And I think that's probably something I've struggled with. Once you have that, you know, I'd set a goal, I'd achieved it, and that feeling of it, and then trying to replicate that is nigh on impossible. I'll never forget that game or that day. I'll tell you a funny story though. I actually roomed with Gavin Henson right before the game, and I went to go to breakfast. I was like, "Gav, you come in breakfast?" And he was like, "Oh, no, but I'm all right. I've got my own food here." And I was like, "He's got his own food. He ain't got anything." Anyway, I went and had breakfast, sausage, bacon, egg, hash browns, fucking everything. I come back and Gav has got a full watermelon that he's cut in half, eating it with a spoon with a baked potato in a bit of foil and a shot of olive oil in a shot glass.
Really?
Yeah. And I came in and I was like, Gav, what on earth are you doing?
What are you doing?
And he went, oh, this is all I fucking need, bud.
Really?
And I was just like, wow, that is, it just cracked me up seeing that. He chopped this watermelon in half and was eating it with a spoon.
And that's all he eats. Is that a pre-game ritual or is that just day-to-day diet?
I think it's a bit of both.
Right.
Because I remember at lunchtimes he used to have that baked potato that was wrapped in a bit of foil and some, like, you know, that really dry bloody turkey you buy, the packet turkey.
Yeah.
It, just that and a potato. That's all he had for lunch. But to be fair, he was shredded.
So. Yeah, he's got a rig to upkeep, doesn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, he's got a rig, and he was about 20 shades darker than me, skin tone as well. So. That obviously helps you look more shredded, but
I know.
Yeah, top boy he is.
Bristol, you get relegated.
Yeah,
that's a shit feeling, right?
Awful.
For you, was that like, oh fuck, I failed again or not?
It was. Yeah, it was. You know, obviously, you know, not down solely to me, but I felt like. I was part of the team, but I felt like we'd failed, and you know it was tough to swallow. You know, we had some really tough games, and we didn't win many games, and back in the champ again, just exactly where I didn't want to be. And I think that showed, to be honest. You know, I was on a 2-year, and I actually asked if I could go get released and go to a Prem club, and they said no. And that again wasn't because I didn't love it at Bristol, because I did, but I was, you know, hell bent on this Prem, and you know that's when Pat came along, and you know even in that champ year I actually didn't play that much, so it was that was a tough year for me, and like I said, it was probably reflected in some of my attitudes that I thought I was didn't want to be in the champ. Unfortunately. And that probably reflected, and that's probably why I didn't play that much. Again, another tough thing to swallow.
I want to shift, well, fast forward to Bristol again, being back in the Prem. You've gone to Bath, right? Bath was a bit, it was a loan, and then back to Bristol. You've been promoted, and I want to come to your injury. So talk me through the run up to the Leicester game, if you can remember it, and then what happened, because your injury in terms of severity is one of the most severe. A lot of rugby players retire through concussion. It's quite unheard of that rugby players retire because of a stroke. So what happened?
Well, I'll run you through the whole thing, but I wasn't consistently playing, and that wasn't because of my rugby. I had a lot of off-field issues that, you know, I think we've spoken about previously, but you know,
and we won't go into on the pod.
Yeah, I mean, we can do it. It was a bad relationship, a really bad one, and caused me a lot of trouble, actually, publicly, privately. You know, it really has. It did set me back, and it's, you know, that again is another IC failure that I've had to swallow and move on from.
What were the ramifications of that? Because when we've spoken, and if you're okay going into it briefly, then that's great.
Yeah.
But we talked a lot about it and between us. And it's a really difficult situation, because your ex-partner became hell-bent on trying to almost ruin your career, as it were.
Yeah. I mean,
filtered through to Bristol and to back
rugby.
To Pat.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, there was one point she posted on the website saying that I was abusive and, you know, alcoholic and drug addict and didn't care about rugby. And that was on the supporters, the Bristol page and the supporters forum. And that was all stuff that I was trying to manage as well as, you know, push on in my rugby career. And it was all these things, these outside factors that led me to not playing a whole heap of games. You know, I got told I wasn't in the right frame of mind.
Do you think you were in the right frame of mind?
No. I think I was... I wasn't... Yeah, I probably wasn't, but, you know, I didn't have a whole lot of help, if I'm honest. And right. I feel like this is probably one of the problems in rugby at the moment that, you know, I will be speaking about, that I think the boys need to be in a position where they can talk openly and honestly to people about these things and get some help for it, you know, get some positive help though. Not like, right, yeah, we're not going to play you for 2 months and yeah, go and sort yourself out, or yeah, go talk to a therapist. Because rugby's very much, we have to show, you have to be the biggest, you have to be the toughest, you've got to be the best. And actually, one of my friends who did from school, who he did the Joe Marler and the Denny Solomona interview, and I thought they were both incredibly honest. But again, I'm sat here thinking, this is another two examples of you know, well known players who have succeeded but also had their failings, and their failings are due to them bottling everything up and feeling they have to be the strongest and the biggest and the best. And, you know, at some point, if you've got some issues going on, that's gonna come crumbling down. And we need to make rugby a sport and a culture and a you know, a group of people that can be honest and open with each other without it affecting their standing in the team. You know, I had so much stuff going on at home that I won't go into, but it was bad. And I wasn't telling anyone. I wasn't telling my family. I wasn't telling my friends. I wasn't telling my colleagues. I wasn't telling anyone. I was just trying to deal with it, and I was trying to mitigate it as much as I could out away from rugby.
But there was a reason for that. There's a reason for that. And you think it's cultural?
I do. And don't get me wrong, some rugby teams have some excellent culture, but I think it's still all based around, you know, being big, tough rugby players and being the strongest and being the best and showing no weakness whatsoever, which is fundamentally wrong. And I've said this, a few times. You have in professional rugby teams, in premiership teams, what, 6 physios and a full-time doctor, right? Looking after rugby players' physical health. What's going to make the difference, right? And this is not just a performance issue and a mental health issue and a welfare issue. What's going to make the difference is people's mental mentality and their mental well-being. And it astounds me that they would have 6 physios and a full-time doctor, and none of them have a team psychologist. Why don't rugby teams have a full-time psychologist who can deal with performance, can deal with mentality, and can deal with any mental health issues that arise? And we're seeing more and more people coming out saying they've struggled in rugby teams, and it still astounds me that this isn't something that happened a long time ago.
I've had a few rugby players now on the podcast, they've all, well, not all of them, but a lot of them have given their own like different stories around how they were really strong. I think Tom Lindsay, when we did his episode, he said that there was an instance, I think at Wasps, where he was really struggling. He was really, really struggling. And he was open about it, how much he was struggling. And he was told to be quiet because he might not be picked, or it might work against him.
Yeah.
That's the kind of... I don't think it's just rugby as well. I think there's a culture in professional sport. But for you in rugby, Will, like, did you have any similar like instances where that was the case?
Yeah, 100%. I had stuff going on that I was trying to keep quiet, just constantly. Issues at home that I was just constantly trying to keep quiet because I knew that I wouldn't get picked. And I was right. I'd stopped getting picked when all the shit started kicking off.
Really?
Yeah. And... you know, and this is not just, like you've said, it's not just related to rugby, but all sports teams. But not only that, I've recently gone into this recruitment, this legal recruitment with Blue Pencil, with a very knowledgeable guy, and talking to him through law firms, they're having the same issues, mental health issues in law firms.
It's fascinating.
Overworking, the stress. You know, all these things, and it's not related, it's not just something in rugby.
It's kind of a pandemic culture, actually.
I think it is, yeah. I think we've become a culture that have to thrive and succeed, and any sort of failings or any like chink in the armor is seen as not good enough. And I think that needs to change. I don't see it being a quick thing, but I see it as a crucial thing.
What could... It sounds like these instances where you were going through really difficult times in your personal life, from the outside looking in, it sounds like... Did you ever say to Bristol that this was going on?
Not directly. Okay. I got called in after certain things had happened, and you know, I got asked to explain them, and I had to say, look, I've got stuff going on at home that I'm struggling to deal with.
Mm. How do they react to that?
It was. You know, I obviously didn't explain the extent of stuff that was going on, but it was kind of, you know, these things are going to affect you playing, which is, you know, it's
obviously they didn't say that in any in they didn't spell that out to you,
but that is the crack, and that is I imagine. Would be the crack at other rugby clubs as well. You know, and at the end of the day, they've got a job to do. Rugby's a business, and they need to succeed in that business. It's their job. But I think, you know, we as a culture at the moment in everything in the world, we're based on success, aren't we? And you know, I think we've lost a bit of humanity along the way. We've lost a bit of that caring nature that made humans what they are. And everything is focused on success and performance, and essentially money is what it comes down to. You know, and I think that, you know, this pandemic has given people a as horrible as it is, has given people a lot of time to think and reflect on saying, you know, are we doing the right things? You know, is the world all about money? Or should we be spending more time at home? Should we be nicer to people? Should we be worrying about people's mental health? You know, these are all the questions that come up in this pandemic, and something that I've been speaking to a lot of people about.
There's going to be a lot of people listening to this who will be from all walks of life. They might be rugby coaches, they might be cricket coaches, they might be players, they might be in legal recruitment, variety of different areas.
Yeah.
I would be very, very interested to know from you, as somebody who has gone through this and has been at the coalface of I suppose a discrepancy in culture, and you've felt like you've come out from the other side and been like that really should change.
Yeah.
In your opinion, what could people have done better?
Well, I think for a start, I think you need to make, and I've said this to about rugby, but it counts for everything, that you being open and honest, showing weakness, asking for help, is not going to affect, you know, your standings in work or whatever it is, rugby in this case. It's not going to affect that. I think that needs to be made clear as, you know, as a group, that's something that doesn't happen. So, you know, I'd like to see more meetings on it, you know, and I think it needs to be more one-on-one stuff. You know, and they did bring in this sort of buddy system at Bristol that, you know, was supposed to be around sort of performance and any issues. But the trouble is, you just don't want to open up. You don't want to say, oh, yeah, I'm struggling. Because then they're like, oh, right, well, you know, the guy who you're talking to goes, oh, I don't want to deal with this. And, you know, they tell the coach and you're in the same problem anyway. So for me, I would like to see right at the start of each season is go, right, if anyone has any issues, you come to me and we deal with it separately to rugby. Mm. And that is not going to affect anything that happens work-wise. Clearly, if your work is affected by it, then, you know, things would have to change. But I think you need to try and create this open and honest culture where you're happy for people to open up and speak about stuff. You know, and when everything's open and honest and people feel comfortable enough to open up, then without any threat of repercussions sort of stuff, then you create a better environment for people to be more comfortable and to share their problems.
So in essence, we're talking about the powers that be above the players, because I think there is an element on the players to have the courage to open up. But yeah. it is the from the top down to say, it is okay for you to talk about this. And actually, it's not just okay. It is, we are really encouraging you to not shy away from this. Let's talk about it. Let's talk about it. Your performance is not, or your selection in the team is not going to be affected by this. Because actually it's going to be detrimental to your playing if your mindset isn't in the right space.
You see, if I was a coach, I'd probably
which
start,
you are now.
Yeah, well, stupid thing to say, wasn't it? I mean, it's slightly different when I only see the lads twice a week on a sort of evening. But certainly, if I was, you know, head coach of a premiership team, I'd make it very clear. I'd have a big meeting on it at the start of the season in sort of pre-season and say, lads, if any of you have any issues at all, family, rugby, whatever, you come and talk to me confidentially. It doesn't affect anything selection-wise or anything like that. It's not going to affect your work. But the only trouble with that is
I was going to ask quickly, Will. What if somebody says to you, I don't believe you? Because what you're asking is to change a cultural shift in rugby, which has been there for fucking decades, right?
Yeah. Well, that's the question. I think maybe, it's a difficult one. You know, I'm hoping doing more stuff like this, you know, in the future, if... people, you know, if I am ever director of rugby somewhere and they say, oh, you know, Matt, you know, I might play this podcast back to them and say, this is where I was at and this is what I felt. And, you know, this is exactly what I want to avoid. And I think the thing I was going to say is what people are worried about is it affecting their work, isn't it? So this is why I've said about bringing in someone independent. If you bring in an independent psychologist, they can help deal with those issues. But I mean, I've got to be honest. I always felt You know, I was seeing a therapist for the last sort of 18 months, and I always felt a huge relief, and I always felt a lot better after I'd spoke to him. And I, and some people aren't going to ask for that help. Some people don't want to ask for that help, you know, for whatever reason. But if that is not forced upon them, but if they're, you know, told,
encouraged, right,
every person is going to have a one-on-one meeting with this full-time psychologist we've got in.
It's really interesting you say that. I was listening to a guy called Stephen Bartlett, who is the CEO, or the former CEO now, of Social Chain. He's a 27-year-old entrepreneur who is he's brilliant, actually. I've got a lot of respect for him. And he ran a company, Social Chain, based in Manchester, and their culture was very young, but therapy, everybody, when they joined the company, therapy was opt out, not opt in.
Right. Yeah, like that. And you know, that's the biggest change that I think rugby can make right now. That's very easy, very quick, and it's not going to cost them a fortune. Look at how much they spend on boys' wages. What's 50 grand or even 100 grand of that to potentially boost the performance and the mental well-being of every player by 2%? Is that a huge cost? I don't think so.
Well, you talk about 2%. I mean, I dread to think how many boys in the Premiership and girls as well are really struggling, and it's not a 2% incremental gain. It is a 45% incremental gain. Like for you, it was huge.
Huge, yeah. Massive.
I talk about therapy quite a lot on the podcast. I've been through a huge amount of people who come onto this on the rut have gone through therapy. What's your experience of therapy?
Mixed. I'll be honest, it's mixed. I've had people that I just didn't get on with. The way they approach stuff I didn't like. And sometimes I found it didn't help. But this last time, you can judge stuff on results. And, you know, I could have gone into a downward spiral after this. I've lost my career. You know, I don't get to see my daughter as much as I'd like, and it could all go. I could go to shit and lose everything. But I feel like I fought back quite well, and you know, it's to do with having that positive mental attitude, which I think this therapy this last time has helped me a lot. Talking to this guy, and he's not judgmental, and he'd tell me if he thought I was wrong or if he thought I could do something better. But
what did you work on?
Different things. Like after my stroke, I had a lot of anxiety, panic attacks. You know, I went from sleeping 14 hours a day, 16 hours a day to 3 hours a day because I just wasn't sleeping. I'd wake up shaking. So we sort of tried to manage my anxiety, but he also gave me different tools to, help with that and help with me sort of moving on with my life and getting over the loss of rugby and stuff like that. So
we'll come on to the stroke in a sec. Like, what tools? Because there'll be a lot of people listening to the. I like sharing people's experiences of getting out of the rut, as we kind of call it. And everybody has their own individual tools and techniques. Mine's a lot of like hypnotherapy and reaffirming my values, etc. And what's my why? Because I'm a big value person, value-driven person. But so, like, what kind of tools were you equipped with?
So there was one issue was trying to not replace rugby, but I wasn't doing anything physical. I couldn't train, and I needed something positive that I could focus on. I always need something to focus on. I'm not the sort of bloke that could ever not work. So I ended up playing golf. And actually, that's become a really positive for me. It's something I really enjoy. It's quite competitive. I mean, I'm bloody awful at it, but, you know, that was one thing. The other thing was you know, I think for me, it was just talking to my therapist was, it was just being able to be open and completely honest without any repercussions was for me the biggest thing I could do. And now I can happily, you know, sit around and be honest with people and, you know, talk about mistakes I've made and stuff and be able to move forward. And it was, I think that's sometimes what, you know, when you talk about bottling up, it's about not being able to be completely honest with yourself and other people. Mm. You know, that for me was a big change. Because like I said to you, I was constantly covering up, wasn't I? Oh, no, everything's fine. Like, we're all good.
That's a big internal cultural shift for you, actually, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely.
Talking about it.
Yeah. Mm.
How powerful was talking?
Huge. Everything. You know, and you know, I've still got some very close friends at Bristol who know exactly everything that's gone on. And, you know, having someone there to just, you know, it's not a lot. It's really not a lot, but turn around and go, yeah, you'll be all right, mate. You're doing well. And it's not a lot, but it just takes a burden off you. And yeah, that was huge for me.
Let's talk quickly about the stroke. And then I've got five questions that I ask everybody who comes on. That stroke is unbelievable, really. Your career was cut short probably by about 3 or 4, maybe 5 years. You're playing against Leicester Tigers at Welford Road, January of this year.
Yeah.
And you go to tackle, do you remember who you tackled?
Yeah, it was one of them big mongy second rows. I can't remember which one it was.
Might have been Will Spencer or something.
Yeah, it could have been, yeah.
Yeah. And you get on the wrong side of the tackle. Talk me through what you remember.
So I've watched a lot of, obviously, footage back of this. And obviously, I was just trying to make an impact. And I just came off the line and tried to absolutely melt it, like as usual. typical me, part of the Mong squad, only back in the Mong squad, I think. But I tried to absolutely melt him and just got my head caught between my shoulder and him. And just flew off him and sort of whiplashed my head on the floor as well. And I was sort of down for a few minutes.
If you've got on the wrong side of him and you've hit your head pretty fucking hard on the ground, which in January is either going to be a bog or it's going to be rock solid. Was there searing pain in the back of your head? Like, because I've watched the footage as well and you're holding your head immediately. So there is clear discomfort there.
Yeah, I think... I don't really remember it that well, but obviously from the footage, I just had a whack and then it didn't feel great. But I remember just thinking, right, we just need to get up and try and stop them scoring. But I was obviously down for a little bit and then, I tried to carry on, but I don't think I played very well.
do you remember the rest of the game?
No, I don't. And actually, I haven't really watched it back properly. I've watched snippets of it back, but it was just remember it, haze and just really? A rapid deterioration when I came off the pitch. Just like awful, couldn't speak. I came off and I was trying to speak, and I was just going like that, just pouring with sweat. Like couldn't walk properly and I luckily Leicester, obviously hometown, mum and dad had come to watch, and I remember the Leicester doctor ringing them and saying you gotta come back, Will's not good, and ended up going into A&E straight from the pitch. Yeah, just you know, spent a few days in A&E, and they, funnily enough, told me I was fine, and I was like, right, okay, well, I'll go and sleep this off, I'll be all right. Got home, I couldn't talk properly, I was just being sick a lot, had vision issues, balance issues, and then when I finally got back to Bristol, like a few weeks later, I went in for this MRI scan, and they were like, you've had a brain bleed. And I was like, right, okay. And I was like, is that bad? Like, I know it obviously sounds bad, but they were like, well, you need to come back in a few weeks when the swelling's gone down and we'll see what the crack is. And came back in and they were like, oh, it's worse than we thought. It's a stroke and the main artery at the back of my brain had ruptured. And they called it like a whiplash event where my brain had sort of slammed into the back of my skull and just burst open this artery. So that's what caused the symptoms and the pains and stuff and issues. And I went and saw a specialist who dealt with boxers and head injuries. And
how dangerous is that injury?
Awful. Yeah, it's bad. You know, chatting to him, he said, actually, I was pretty lucky. You know, I'm pretty lucky to be functioning well the way I am. I've had some good rehab and some good therapy that's really helped push that on. And it's, you know, I went to speak to him a few weeks after, and I was like, look, what's the crack we're playing? And he said, do you want me to be honest? And I said, yeah, look, just be honest. And he said, if you go back and you hit your head again in any sort of similar way or hit your head at all, he said, and that bleed happens, he said, the very best case scenario is you will not remember anything moving forward or previously. He said, you'll lose your memory. He said, middle range, you'll be in a wheelchair. And he said, top range, you'll be dead. So that pretty much sealed it for me. Like, I was like, well,
what was that moment like receiving that news?
To be honest, I was still in a bit of a haze. Having a stroke is like, I kind of describe it as being sort of like a little bit drunk. And, you know, I sort of was kind of in a haze and it didn't quite register. I'll tell you when it did register in a big way is, you know, we had that break of the Premiership games. And
yeah,
that first game back, I can't remember what sort of date it was, maybe May or something, or April or anyway.
Yeah,
it was the return of those games, and I was watching it with a couple of people, a couple of mates, and my missus, new missus, and I broke down. I was just gone. I was gone. I was done, mate.
Really?
I was done. Yeah. I was like, I can't deal with it. And yeah, that was when it all just hit me. It all just hit me in one, like a fucking train. And I was just like, I'm never going to run out on the pitch again. I'm never going to be in there with the boys again. And I felt like everything I'd worked for had just been taken away from me in that moment. And that was tough. And that really was tough. And that's...
It's difficult to listen to.
Yeah, it's not very nice. I'm getting a little bit emotional now, but I remember that day, and that was, yeah, probably one of the hardest days of my life. After even after stuff I've been through and mistakes I've made, that is probably the hardest. And you know, just having to, and it was watching my teammates as well, you know, not being out there with them is awful. It's awful. Very hard to bounce back from that, but I did quite quickly, luckily.
What are the kind of I suppose physical repercussions that have stayed with you post the injury?
I do have a lot of issues with my memory, and a lot of speech issues, especially when I get tired. You know, I'd see myself as quite a well-spoken, like a fairly intelligent bloke beforehand, could talk quite well to anyone. But, you know, it's made me slower, which is a bit frustrating. Mm. It's made things, I have to think about things a lot more. And when I say stuff, I lose words. So in conversations like this, I will lose words, and I tend to have a break and try and find different ways of saying stuff, which is the sort of rehab I'd had before. But it can be frustrating when, you know, I know what I'm trying to say, but I can't say it. Mm. You know, there's things like that, you know, and I've had issues with sleep. I'm not quite as sharp as I was before, and I do get tired really easily sometimes. And, you know, middle of the day, I'll end up having to go and sleep for an hour because I'll be sat there and I'll just be gone. So yeah, it's been a pretty tough thing to manage, to be fair.
Mate, you're a top man. That is it's difficult to listen to. And as somebody who is a rugby Norse through and through and knows the impact of concussions and injuries, and having had 6 or 7 rugby players now on this podcast who have all explored challenges, that it's hard. So yeah. It's just nice. It's nice to see you as a mate. Be in a good place, in a better place, and describing it as bouncing back is really, really nice, because it's a serious fucking injury.
Yeah, it's been life changing, no doubt. Completely, you know, redone my life. But like you say, you know, I like to pride myself on my bounce back, and you know, I feel like I've done that pretty well till now. I got to let go of the mistakes I've made and let go of you know, playing rugby. And they're two things that I'm still working on, but it's a long process. I have to remember it's a marathon, not a sprint.
You know? Oh yeah. So, I've got 5 questions for you.
Sweet.
Let's go. Number one, what's your favorite book and why?
Favorite book? Oh man. Do you know what? Actually, it's not really a book, but it is a book, but it's no one will know what it is. I actually can't remember the title of it. It's this big maths book I've got. Right. And yeah, I know, it's an absolute nerd thing.
That wasn't the type of answer I was expecting, actually.
Yeah,
okay, why do you love it?
It's just it just explores some really interesting stuff. It's maths and physics, and it goes into loads of detail over stuff and equations and all sorts of.
But you're a mathematician at heart, right?
Yeah, I did maths at Aston. So that's, yeah, I'm a bit of a maths nerd, but yeah,
I like
it's this book. It's the only thing I've read in the last sort of 6 months, to be honest. It's
good for you. What lesson have you learned in your life that you know is true but you kind of hate?
What lesson have you learned in life?
What lesson have you learned in your life that you know is true, but you kind of hate?
Oh, God. No, it's true. Wow, that's a difficult one. I'd probably say that money talks. Okay. Money talks, because money's at the center of everything, but I hate that.
Interesting. That's it. I love that answer. I haven't had that one before. We've done 25, recorded almost 25 episodes of this new season, and I haven't had that one before.
No.
It's interesting.
Yeah, I think that money, like I spoke about before about humanity, I think money is probably one of the main driving factors in the loss of humanity we've got and the increase in the mental health.
Okay, nice. Number three, your friend who's having a tough time at the moment picks up the phone, rings you, and says he's having a really, really bad day today. What do you say?
I'll be over in 10 minutes. That's what I'd say to him. Never let people be on their own. And it's always easier to do these things face to face. It means more and you get that proper connection. So I'd just say to him, I'll be over. Give me 5 minutes and I'll come over.
Nice. Like that. Number four, when you're struggling with something, struggling yourself, what's your go-to? What do you do to improve things?
It depends what it is, but I tend to try and have a reset where I will try and forget about it for a small period and then try and deal with it when I come back. So, you know, recently for me, that's been golf, actually. If I can get on the golf course, then that's pretty much all that matters at that point in time. And I've got then a good 4 hours to think about something. to think about golf other than anything else. And that's almost like a little reset for me.
That's really nice. Doing a Gareth Bale, get on the golf course.
Yeah, he's probably a lot better than me. I'm absolutely terrible.
I think he plays off four, so he probably is, yeah.
Oh, does he?
yeah.
Do you know why it is, right? And I'll tell you this, Matt Banahan, he also plays off four. It's these lanky buggers, mate.
Does he really?
Yeah, these lanky buggers, they got long swingy arms and they hit the ball miles and it always goes straight. It's,
Christ, Matt Banahan plays off four. Wow, that's impressive.
Last time he told me it was four. He's,
probably gone down now. Amazing. Who knew?
Yeah.
Number five, you're lying on your deathbed, looking back at your life. What are you most proud of?
I would say, you know, what I've managed to achieve from places where I've been, it would have been very easy to just sort of give up. I feel like I've fought well to achieve what I have. And, you know, that and my daughter are the two biggest things I can be proud of. You know, and also, you know, feeling like I'm, you know, my mum and dad are a huge thing in my life, and you know, I've spent a lot of time with them recently, and that's an invaluable bit of time that a lot of people don't actually have. So those three things for me are hugely important.
It's really nice. It's been a wonderful hour and 20 minutes.
Cheers.
And it's been far too, we've been threatening to do this for way too long. We've blamed it on your memory, but I'm really I've got to give thanks to Tom Lindsay for connecting us, I'm really, really glad we've got this out there in the open, and thank you so much for talking so openly about your journey, your injury, your opinions on mental health, because you've been at the forefront of it now for a while, and it's great to hear.
Cheers, mate. I appreciate that. And thanks for having me as well.
No problem. We'll get this out there soon. And where can people find you?
You're
on Twitter and Instagram, aren't you?
Yeah, Twitter, Instagram, Facebook and LinkedIn. If anyone needs any decent recruiter,
there you go, great plug for the thousands of listeners.
Blue Pencil, yeah, no, it's you know.
And what do Blue Pencil do, quickly?
So Blue Pencil are they're an international legal recruitment firm that guy Liam Mooney's been running since 2002, and he's a fantastic man and very passionate, and you know, we're both of the ilk that you know, we don't just offer recruitment services, we're, you know, We are doing a big push on mental health, like me and you are today. And it's, you know, that's part of things moving forward. And we want to you know, help businesses grow. And part of that is finding the right people to fit into their companies. So, yes.
Yeah. Nice. Good little plug there for Blue Cheers, Pencil. Mate. I'll be taking Cheers, commission.
2%.
My man, thank you so much for coming on. Great to see you.
Cheers. Thanks, Frank.